Call to order, time 5:08 PM on this third day of March 2009. The court will now hear the matter of Varney versus SGA Executive Staley. The court has granted the petitioner a hearing on the basis whether SGA Executive has the authority to terminate the employment of the Student Senate Executive Assistant, Mr. Varney. And the court refuses to hear any discussion or comment regarding reasons for termination of employment, and we will stop the proceeding if anyone starts discussing these things. Throughout the case, petitioners will be referred to as Mr. Varney and Mr. Mock, and the respondent we will refer to as Mr. Staley. Please refer to the justices by justice and then their last name. And the gallery needs to remain silent, or as silent as possible the entire time. And the court will not address anyone in the gallery, and the gallery should not try to address the court or the petitioner or respondent. Okay, first I'm going to explain the process here to begin with. The proceeding is being recorded and will be transcribed at a later date for meeting minutes. And then we're going to start with preliminary motions. Each party will be allowed 2 minutes to per motion, and then the other party will be allowed 2 minutes to respond to that motion. And then the court will vote on each motion. Once both parties are heard, well, like I said, we're going to vote on the motion. If the court needs to take a recess for 5 minutes to discuss the motion before we vote, we'll do that at that time. Then the court will move to the next motion, if necessary, until all motions are exhausted. And then once the court has finished voting on the motions, then we'll proceed to the case at hand. Okay, first, the court will hear from Mr. Mock regarding the motion sanction Staley, and you have 2 minutes.
The petitioner filed a motion on March 1st, 2009 due to Mr. Staley's violation of the student court bylaws. Section 4, subsection D states that involved parties in any action must present a brief including all points of their argument to the court 3 business days prior to oral argument. Mr. Staley failed to do so. He was to submit oral arguments this brief on February 28th, and we did not receive that brief in electronic form until yesterday, right around 2 o'clock. That was March 2nd. Mr. Staley has provided a written copy of his brief as it is. The original motion was to exclude his written brief from deliberation and from the oral argument because it was late and it is a violation. However, I sent an informal email to the Chief Justice yesterday, basically rescinding that, and instead I would prefer that the court sanction the amount of time that Mr. Staley has to address the court in oral arguments and in rebuttal, because the amount of time that we were allowed to prepare for oral arguments and a rebuttal, basically our time was cut in half. I saw that as being a tactical advantage, that Mr. Staley had done this probably purposely to either delay proceedings or to put him more at a favorable position. I also learned through the weekend that Mr. Staley had put up a Facebook group publicizing this event and this hearing. That was on February 27th. Apparently if he has time to make a Facebook group and to publicize the event, then I would think that he would have time as well to make his brief in consideration of both the petitioner and the court. In that regard, because our time was cut in half, I would ask that you entertain a motion to cut his time in half for all arguments and rebuttal.
Okay. Mr. Staley?
Well, the reason for the late submission was a simple miscommunication between myself and Chief Justice Schmidt. I was told that my exhibits needed to be turned in, all of my supporting documents needed to be hard copies turned into the court's mailbox by Monday morning. I was under the impression that included all materials, and I proceeded as such until I received an informal email from Chief Justice Schmidt telling me that I needed to email in my brief. I would also like to note that the February 28th deadline that was given would not have been 3 business days in advance of the court case, that it would have been 2 business days as the 28th fell on a Saturday. So regardless of whether or not I adhered to the deadline that was initially imposed, it would still not have justified the 3-day rule that Mr. Mock is supposing I was to adhere to. It was just a simple miscommunication. There was no intentional tactical movement.
Justice Schmidt, could I have one comment?
Sure.
This is really quick. Mr. Staley had 15 days to prepare all of this documentation. He had ample time to prepare, so there's really no excuse for this not being on time.
Okay. Mr. Staley?
No further comment.
Okay. Any questions?
No.
Questions?
No.
Okay.
Go ahead and throw it in.
Okay. All right, at this time, I will entertain a motion to sanction Mr. Staley and preclude the respondent from presenting a brief or a response to the court.
I'll motion the sanction.
Okay. Question's been called. Is there any objection to calling question? All right, seeing none, I will move into a vote of the show of hands. All those in favor?
Abstention.
Okay. All those against? Okay. Motion failed, 050. I'd like to entertain a second motion to sanction Mr. Staley's argument time by a 20% reduction.
I'll make the motion for the sanction of 20% reduction.
Call the question.
Okay.
Second.
Okay.
Call the question.
All right. Question's been called. Any objection to calling the question? Seeing none, we'll move into another vote by a show of hands. All those in favor? Okay. All those against? Okay. Motion failed, 05. Okay. Now, Mr. Staley, do you have a motion regarding dismissal on the grounds of standing?
Yes. I would like to request that this court entertain a motion to dismiss this case on the grounds that petitioner Mr. Barney has no standing to file a complaint with this court. As shown in Exhibit A, which was attached to the motion, Mr. Barney was admittedly not a member of SGA, which directly contradicts Section 1 of the petitioner's writ. The question at hand is also pertaining to a position outlined in Article 6 of the Student Government Association Senate bylaw, not the SGA Constitution. The term administrative assistant or executive assistant does not appear in the Student Government Association Constitution, strictly in Article 6 of the Senate bylaws. And therefore, Mr. Barney lacks standing pursuant to Article 3, Section 1, Subsection 4, as claimed in Section 1 of the petitioner's writ.
Finished? Okay. And Mr. Mock?
First off, it doesn't matter whether or not Mr. Barney believed that he was a member of the court. It's a matter of whether or not it was in the bylaws. And in fact, it is. In Article 6, the title is Officer of the Senate. Article 6 goes on to explain that there are 2 officers of the Senate, the Senate Speaker and the Executive Assistant. By virtue, an officer of the Senate is going to be considered a member of SGA. Furthermore, the Executive Assistant is also on the SGA payroll. This just goes to support the fact that he is in fact a member. He might not be a voting member. He's probably more ex officio of anything, but he is in fact a member. Second, in regards to the bylaws, this court has never precluded itself from reviewing bylaws, and in fact, it has reviewed bylaws in the past. In SG Executive versus SUFAC, we reviewed standing rules. We also reviewed bylaws. That was a budget appeal case, but it's still bylaws. The court can still review this. I'd also like to mention that in SGA Executive versus the Senate, this was a court case that had to deal with the procedures of authorship and whether or not chairs can do this. And in that particular case, we addressed bylaws quite explicitly. It was all about bylaws. This court has done it in the past. Bylaws are also derived from the Constitution. They're viewed basically as an extension of proper procedures for the organization, but they're not to be in conflict with the Constitution. So, that said, I think that addresses just about everything. And actually, one more note. In Mylander versus, excuse me, before the state, Mylander was not even a member of SGA, and this court reviewed that case anyway. So there's a historical precedent here that you review bylaws, and even non-SGA members can come to this court. But clearly, Mr. Varney was an SGA member. So I'd ask you to not grant that petition, or excuse me, that motion.
Okay. Any questions?
No.
Questions? No? All right. I'll entertain a motion to dismiss the case on the grounds of standing.
Motion is seconded.
I'll call the question.
Okay. Question has been called. Any objections to calling question? Okay, seeing none, we'll vote by a show of hands. All those in favor? Okay. All those against? All right, motion failed. 05. Moving on, next motion, Mr. Staley. We have a motion to dismiss on the grounds of mootness.
Mm-hmm.
You have 2 minutes.
I'd also like to respectfully request that this court entertain a motion to dismiss this case on the grounds that the petitioner, Mr. Varney, has no redress of grievances available to him, and therefore the case is moot. In the end of the petitioner's writ, there were four sections granting relief. As one of those has been thrown out and he has already been granted standing, I see no ability for this court to redress Mr. Varney's grievances. In addition, Speaker Sibula has already hired a new executive assistant, and the position has been filled, and he was the only person that could make the final call as to whether or not Mr. Varney would be hired back to his initial position.
Okay, Mr. Mott.
This petition was filed on the principle of separation of powers, and we're looking to adjudicate whether or not who has the ultimate authority, or if two people have the authority to terminate the employment of the Senate Executive Assistant. It's based on principle. We're not looking for any type of recourse. If we were, however, and if we were perhaps in the state court or the federal court, there would be three courses of redress that we've been looking for. One would first be reinstatement. Obviously, we can't do that right now because there's been someone hired, and that was for administrative reasons. The court date came too late. We'd be asking for that if we could. The second, and if the court has to hang their head on something, then I guess this would be it. We'd ask for compensatory damages, lost wages. There was approximately 5.5 hours of work that wasn't paid to him. If the court were to find that that he was wrongfully terminated, then we'd ask for that if it's necessary. But we prefer not to. It's $39.20. That's not why we're here. We're here to adjudicate the issue. So in that respect, I don't think this is going to be moved. And quite frankly, we're here to delineate those lines of authority.
Okay. All right, I'll entertain a motion at this time to dismiss the case on the grounds of mootness.
Second motion.
Okay.
Call the question.
Okay, question's been called. Any objection to calling a question?
No.
Okay. Seeing none, we'll vote by a show of hands again. All those in favor? Okay. All those against? All right, motion fails, 05. And, all right, the court would like to make a statement before we move on. I meant to do this earlier. Even though we chose not to sanction Mr. Staley, the court would like to express its displeasure with the situation. We're disappointed that Mr. Staley waited until the last moment to filed his response. That's our statement. All right, moving on. For the rest of the proceeding, the petitioner, you will have 15 minutes to present your oral arguments. 1 minute. Do you have another motion? Either of you have another motion?
No, actually, I was usually during these proceedings, we are given 5 minutes for a whole statement. I don't know if that's something that you're willing to do or not. But
no, it's part of your 15 minutes oral argument. Okay? So, petitioner will have 15 minutes to present their oral arguments, followed by the respondent will also receive 15 minutes. Then the petitioner will have another 5 minutes for rebuttal, followed by 5 minutes for rebuttal by the respondent. And then once this is complete, the court will have 15 minutes to ask questions. The court will keep track of the remaining time for arguments and will warn each party when 2 minutes remains of their time. And if either party exceeds their allotted time, we will interrupt them and proceed with the rest of the hearing. So, Mr. Mock and Mr. Varney, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may I please report. I think it's important to establish a record in this case, considering I think it's essential to do this, actually. So, I'll just go through the basics of what actually happened. Mr. Varney was hired by Speaker Nick Sabula on September 2008. Varney performed the task of an executive assistant, which is outlined in Article 6 of the bylaws. It's taking minutes. It's secretarial work. That's the nature of what he did. On December 8th, 2008, Ricky, the respondent, met with the student's office regarding Barney's employment. At that meeting, they apparently determined that they had the executive authority to terminate his employment under Article 2, Section 1, Subsection 1, and Article 2, Section 1, Subsection 7, without consulting the Speaker of the Senate. The very last meeting of the Senate concluded, and Mr. Staley announced that he was going to hold an executive meeting. At that meeting, he announced that he'd be terminating Mr. Varney's employment immediately. And during that meeting, Speaker Sabula had mentioned that he did believe that the bylaws or the Constitution read that way, that he was questioning whether or not Mr. Staley had the authority to do so. To avoid escalation, and like we said, we're not going to get into the specifics of what actually happened, but Speaker Sabula decided to deliver Staley's decision in person, given how poorly the situation was handled. It was basically to calm the waters. He thought, no, I have a personal relationship with Mr. Varney. I'd rather handle this by myself. Because at that point, everything was over. Nick wasn't going to question what was going on. It was done at that point. And it should be noted for the record that Speaker Sabula did not participate in the executive decision to make this termination. And he was simply a messenger. I mean, he delivered the message. There should be no confusion on this point that Speaker Sabula had anything to do with this. He delivered the message. He didn't make the decision himself. And that's actually reflected within his affidavit. And you can look at points 12 and 13 for a specific reference. The respondent makes, I guess, some confusing remarks about some email conversations that took place. I personally think they're irrelevant to what happened afterwards. There was obviously some confusion about the lines of authority, hence the reason why we are here today. Andre questioned whether or not he had the authority. He was told that by Speaker Sabula that Mr. Staley had the authority, so he had to hear it from him. So there was an exchange back and forth. It's reasonable to expect that when someone's being terminated for their position and there's no clear line of authority. I mean, maybe I'm off my record on this, but it seems reasonable to me. So that is essentially the record as we know it. I think turning towards the analysis, it's quite clear that Article 6 is the most direct and clear language that we have governing this case in regards to the Senate executive's employment. Speaker Sabula, as it says in Article 6, shall be responsible for the hiring and supervising of the Senate executive assistant. Presumably, if the Senate Speaker has the authority to hire his assistant, then I think it's reasonable to assume that he can also fire him. The respondent really doesn't challenge that in his brief. He says the facts are undisputed, and then he adds some other things that personally I think are irrelevant, and I'll get into that later. But he doesn't dispute that the speaker does have the authority to fire his assistant if he so wishes. This court has, so I guess the question before you then is whether the executive branch also holds that authority. And I think the answer is absolutely no. The court has in the past recognized the concept of separation of powers. In our petition, we cite two cases which the court recognizes this. FGA Executive versus SGA Senate and FGA Executive versus SUFAC. The respondent claims in his brief that we miscited these cases and that they're irrelevant and they have no holding in this. But I beg to differ with what his assessment is. Just because the term separation of powers does not appear expressly in the court's opinion doesn't mean that the overarching concept is not within those opinions. So, for example, in FGA Executive versus Senate, the issue before the court was whether or not the executive chairs could perform the traditional and essential duties of the legislative branch. For example, authorship, co-sponsorship, and sponsorship of legislation. Traditionally, that's always been a function of the legislator. But the case before it was whether or not the executive chairs, also have the authority to do some of these things. And what the court decided was that the executive chairs could introduce, sponsor, and write these as long as a full member of the Senate has also done the same thing, that somehow they're involved in the process. So what they did was they limited it. So yes, there's some connection between the two. There are some corresponding similarities, but ultimately there's a separation of powers that the Senate has to be a part of this. And I think that's important to recognize, that the overarching concept of that has to deal with separation of powers. Perhaps the respondent just missed that. Second case that we cite is FGA Executive versus SUFAC. I highly doubt I miscited this case considering I wrote the opinion myself. I think I'm pretty familiar with the case at hand. That's just my personal opinion. In that case, the court delineated the lines of authority between the executive branch, SUFAC, and the Senate, and went in improving the FGA budget. That one is a more complicated case, but again, the overarching theme in that case had to deal with separation of powers and who has the authority to do what. It's been recognized in this court. There's no doubt about that. And the reason why I keep bringing this issue up and why I think it's important is because the employment of the Senate executive is overseen by the Speaker, and only the Speaker. For the executive to also assume that they have this responsibility, I believe is a clear violation of that separation of powers. And I guess to illustrate my point and perhaps put this into context in a government aspect, imagine Nancy Pelosi hires an assistant. I highly doubt that Barack Obama can just say, well, you know what, for these following reasons, I don't like you, we're going to fire you. I mean, that line of logic just doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. The point that I'm making is that essentially SGA is the government. We have three branches, we have separate powers, we have checks and balances, but in the same way, it's structured in a way that allows each branch to work cooperatively. And the problems arise in SGA when there are other branches of government who are trying to assume the authorities of other branches. Let's just assume for a second that we accept Mr. Staley's argument that he obtained some mystical executive authority to oversee clearly established duties of the Senate or even this court. What does that mean for SGA in the future? I think we run into some major problems if we give the executive a blanket check to start overseeing the functions of the court or the Senate. And that is essentially what he did in this case. Article 6 clearly establishes that the Speaker is to oversee, hire, supervise, I argue terminate also, the employment of the Senate Executive Assistant. And what Mr. Staley essentially did was, well, I think I have that power too, under such and such sections of the Constitution, and essentially I can do the same thing. I can perform these duties also. quite frankly, it's scary to me that the executive has somehow obtained this, and he cites sections, again, that I think are irrelevant, and I'll get that into my rebuttal. And that's just outlining the ruling in favor of the respondent at this point. A ruling in favor of the petitioner is actually quite different. The speaker has the sole authority to hire, supervise, and terminate, as I think I have tried to prove to you, that just through assumption, if someone has the authority to hire, essentially they also have the power to terminate. And there are three things that I would like to leave with the court when you start thinking about the analysis, and one is that a ruling in favor of the petitioner is narrow enough where it's not going to affect other branches of the student government. And essentially what I mean by that is it doesn't give the speaker any more authority than what was already presumed. I mean, essentially what you're doing is saying, you know what, you're right. The speaker has the authority to fire the Senate executive assistant. It does nothing else. I mean, there is nothing else that comes out of this in the outcome. It also establishes a clear line of authority between the executive assistant and the speaker, which there already is, but it reestablishes this fact. And it also asserts the separation of powers, which I've mentioned before, that we've seen this, and the reason why we try to separate it is so we can function effectively and efficiently and with not a lot of interruption, but at the same time we work cooperatively with everybody else. For these three points that I just mentioned, I think they're the most logical, the most well-reasoned outcome of the analysis that the court can give in light of Article 6 and the Constitution. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Okay. Mr. Staley, you have 15 minutes to respond.
Thank you. One common misconception that was stated in both the petitioner's brief as well as your arguments is that I personally terminated Mr. Varney, and this is simply not true. On December 8, 2008, I announced Mr. Varney's termination to the SGA Executive Board and Speaker Stibula. The decision to terminate Mr. Varney was reached at a meeting between Vice President Blanke, Dean Kine, Assistant Dean Amundson Hill, and myself. It was during this meeting that all parties agreed that as the executive members, myself and Vice President Blanke had the authority to execute the termination of employment based on our standing as the chief financial officers of the organization and the position of the vice president as the chairman of the student senate. This decision was reached collaboratively. This is not a simple, the president fired the executive assistant. This was a collaborative decision reached not only between a member of the executive, but a member of SGA that plays a dual role in the Senate and executive leadership. Mr. Stibula did notify Mr. Varney of his termination. The physical proof that we have of this was an email, which I have included as Exhibit B. Mr. Varney responded to Speaker Stibula's email stating, since Ricky has the ultimate authority to discharge me of my duties, I need to hear it from him. And that is a direct quote taken from Exhibit C. This is in direct contradiction to an email Mr. Varney sent to Chairman Fisher 4 days earlier in which Mr. Varney states, Ricky cannot fire me. It's also in direct contradiction to an email Mr. Varney sent me personally in response to my email notifying him of his termination, which is the second email included in Exhibit A, in accordance to what he requested in Exhibit C. In his response to myself, Mr. Varney states, I don't think you have the authority to fire me. This put us in a gray area of time where Mr. Varney refused to acknowledge the speaker's notification that he was terminated or an executive notification that he was terminated. This is where we get into the 5 hours and 40 minutes of administrative work that Mr. Varney attempted to pursue payment for after receiving both notifications.
I have to
of termination.
Object to this. This is irrelevant to what the case is, what happened afterwards. We're here to adjudicate whether or not he has the authority. What happened after the firing is essentially irrelevant to the case.
That's true. Continue.
Noted. Moving on. In Article 2, Section 1, subsection of the SGA Constitution, it's clearly stated that the executive power shall be vested in a president of the Student Government Association. the initial assumption, or reasonable interpretation, as Mr. Mock has put it, that Speaker Sidula had the authority to terminate employment was also made by myself and Vice President Blanke initially. It was after, as seen in Exhibit G, that Speaker Sidula refused to take any action towards termination after two separate meetings in which we discussed the role of Mr. Varney and his employment. It was only after these two meetings took place that I acted in an executive manner, executing the decision that was made collaboratively between myself and Vice President Blanke at the meeting discussed in point C of my response. The two cases that were raised, the SGA executive versus Senate, I do not feel is relevant to this case. The chairs do not act in a position or in the same role that the president does. I really don't see how a tie in legislation between a committee chair and the interpretation of executive as chief financial officer and executor of the will of student government as a whole ties into procedural running of the Senate. In regard to the SGA v. SUFAC case, while we are discussing a separation of powers, I think it's very important to note that Vice President Blanke, in his vice presidential role, is expressly the chairman of the Senate. Therefore, this decision was not simply some closed-door executive decision made, but rather from the chief executive officer of student government and the chief officer of the student Senate. It was a collaborative decision, and I cannot stress that enough. I would also like to add that nowhere in the SGA Constitution or Senate bylaws is anyone afforded the ability to terminate employment of the executive assistant. This led us to the gray area that I discussed earlier, where there were two notifications sent out regarding employment, and there was no action taken by the petitioner. Moving down, I would like to request that this court make a recommendation to the Senate to expressly assign the duty of termination. The reason that we're in the quagmire we're in is that we can reasonably interpret either position as the Speaker to have the authority to terminate, or the President and Vice President in collaboration as both executive and chief financial officers to have such authority, as there is no authority expressly derived from either document. I would ask that the court recommend to the Senate an expressly assigned position, whether it falls under the executive or whether it falls under the vice president or the Speaker of the Senate or whomever the Senate deems necessary to afford that authority to. The Senate is the only body that can change the Constitution or their own bylaws, and I think that it would be prudent for the court to recommend to the Senate that they explicitly assign that duty. Thank you.
Okay. And Mr. Mock and Mr. Varney, do you have you have 5 minutes for a rebuttal?
The Wisconsin Statute 36905 reads, the students in each institution, referring to the UW system, shall have the right to organize themselves in the manner that they determine. SGA has chosen to organize itself in a government, three branches, separation of powers in conjunction with the checks and balances. Our Constitution mirrors the federal government. That's not a consequence. We have that for a reason. Excuse me, coincidence. The respondent's argument sounds as if the SGA were to be set up like a business. As if SGA's flowchart were to be almost like a pyramid where you have the executive at the very top, and apparently the executive, as Mr. Staley has said, that's the officer of the chief officer of the budget and this executive power, that the power flows from above and goes down like this, basically, that somehow the court falls somewhere in that gray part and the Senate, that it all comes right from the top. Under the respondent's model, just take this for example, apparently Article 2, Section 1, Subsection 1, which reads, the executive power shall be vested in a president of SGA. That establishes that there's going to be a president. It's nothing else. That particular subsection establishes a precedent. And after that, in that section, it outlines what the executive's duties are. Basically, what he is deduced from this is that his authority derives because he's somehow the executive, and that he just has this authority to do what it is he needs, and that he can start firing people as he sees fit. He can start performing.
Speculation.
Sustained.
He can start, that, just forget out of my thoughts. That as the chief financial officer and as the president, that he can deduce that authority to fire someone from the Constitution. That's essentially what he has done from perhaps this pyramid. That's what it sounds like to me, at least. If you look at the section in the Constitution, it's Article 2, Section 1, Subsection 8. That's where it talks about the budget. And basically what it says is that the president can compile, review, and submit a budget. It gives him no other authority besides that. So I have a hard time accepting that particular line of thought, that because he's the executive officer of this budget, that he has the authority to fire Mr. Barney. That is not a reasonable interpretation of that particular section of the Constitution.
2 minutes.
And lastly, in regards to the vice president and his role within the Senate, he's an ex officio member. He does get one vote if there's a tie. Traditionally, he's presided over meetings. But other than that, he does nothing else in the Senate. He has his own executive assistant. And if need be, it says in Article 6 that he can assign duties to the Senate. But that rarely never happens. As I mentioned, the respondent is relying on sections in the Constitution that basically have nothing to do with the procedure of the Senate. They want you to interpret a broadly worded provision in hope that you will forget about Article 6 of the Student Senate Bylaws. Those sections of the Constitution have been interpreted to mean that he has basically created this mythical authority to fire the assistant, that he has deduced this from the establishment of the president within the Constitution and this officer, and that somehow that's where he's getting this authority. And I'd like to stress that the authority lies with the Speaker through Article 6. It doesn't come anywhere else. He's precluded from doing anything that is well established as the Speaker's role and responsibilities. That's the reason why we have that in bylaws to begin with. And my last point is that if the Senate wanted the Vice President to have any say in his employment, they probably would have stated in Article 6, which they did. Maybe they forgot, I don't know. But I doubt that. Mm-hmm. It's with the Speaker. That's all there is to it. The language is clear.
Okay. Mr. Staley, 5 minutes for rebuttal.
In regards to Mr. Mock's argument of myself and Vice President Blanchi seeing SGA as a business, we simply see it as another section of the shared governance within our university system, much like the chancellor's office would be to administrators in that area. Similarly, the vice president and I are the executive officers to the budget. We sign off on all budgetary matters. We are responsible for the compilation of the budget, and therefore the Constitution can be reasonably interpreted that executive power does pertain to the budget, as that is how it is worked out in practice and daily operations of the board. The vice president does not have an executive assistant. In fact, there are two assistants provided for in the budget, one for SUPAC and one for the Senate. The argument made there seems irrelevant to me. That can be found in the SGA budget, that there are two, and in practice, the Senate and the SUPAC board have taken priority in terms of having an administrative assistant. We're not asking the court to forget about Article 6. In fact, we've also brought up Article 6. Article 6 does not give anyone the authority to terminate the administrative assistant's employment, neither does the Constitution. Maybe the Senate did forget to put it in there when they were writing the bylaws or the Constitution, but the simple fact remains that nowhere in either document is this authority afforded, and it'll be up to the Senate to fix or not adjust either document with their clear will as to who would have this authority. That is something that I would contend needs to be left up to the Senate, and I would ask the court to act accordingly, recommending that the Senate fix the gray area.
Okay. Now the court will ask questions for 15 minutes. Anyone have questions?
I have a question. Speaker Sebelio, how do you say it? Sebelio wasn't included in the meeting that the two of you had with Sue Kine and the rest of the members that attended the meeting. Why wasn't he included? Was he asked to come to the meeting?
No, this meeting was actually not specifically held to discuss Mr. Varney's employment. It was a regular meeting that Vice President Blanke and I have with our advisors. Dean Kine serves as the direct advisor for the President and Vice President, and Assistant Dean Anderson Hill serves as the advisor for the Executive Board. So this was a meeting that occurred regularly.
And at this meeting, the termination of Varney was just discussed, like, impromptu, or...?
Without getting into specifics, the topic had been raised, as I said, with two separate meetings I had with Speaker Sebelio, as well as various other discussions that were had amongst people through the office. So it was kind of a buzz in the office. It wasn't something that just popped out of the blue.
But a discussion with Speaker Sebelio did not occur prior to your meeting?
Two separate meetings with myself and Speaker Sebelio occurred prior to the meeting with the dean.
My question was asked.
Okay. That's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Article 2, Section 3, Subsection 2 of the Constitution states that the chair of segregated fees is not subject to removal by the president and can only be impeached and removed by a two-thirds vote of the Senate. In your opinion, Mr. Mack or Mr. Varney, does this imply that the SGA president does have the power to terminate or remove officials?
He does have the authority to terminate his executive chairs, which he appoints. That's
okay.
Part of the executive.
It says the chair of the segregated fees,
right.
That's SUFAC, right?
Yes, and he appoints that person.
Is not subject to removal.
No, and that's probably...
So my question is, he can remove an
official.
My question is, you believe that the SGA president, according to what we have in the Constitution, can remove an official from power?
He can remove any chair that he appoints, except for the SUFAC chair, and I believe it's because they don't want... It's a political reason. If decisions that are being made that the president doesn't like, you can't just remove the SUFAC chair. It's up to the Senate to do that.
And I think it's important to stress that the executive assistant has in no position of power. That carrying out the secretarial work of the Senate, they don't have a vote, they don't have a voice. So I think that's a good distinction to make. So,
okay. So the executive assistant doesn't have a vote or a voice. In essence, you're not saying the executive assistant's position is, you know, irrelevant or of no consequence.
Basically, to the Student Government Association, is of no consequence, except to carry out the secretarial work.
Okay.
Has no voice in making decisions, nothing like that. Basically, sit at a computer and do the minutes. That's really all I do. No political position whatsoever. And
this position had what kind of a fee associated with it?
It's an hourly wage, $7 per hour, 10 hours a week, so 20 hours biweekly.
In my humble opinion, I don't see how such a position would be irrelevant. Thank you very much. You guys have answered my question. And that'll be it for now.
All right. Mr. Staley, do you believe that you are able to terminate the positions of any and all paid employees in SGA? Or where do you draw the line? Do you think, for instance, that you would be able to terminate the employment of justices?
No, I do not. That is expressly forbidden in the Constitution. I believe it's in the court's bylaws that discusses the lifetime appointments of the court. I'm not 100% sure if that does appear in the Constitution. Obviously, the chair of the segregated university fee allocation committee is expressly forbidden from termination by the president. that is in the Constitution of the court. All the other executive members of the executive board are subject to termination by the president in collaboration with the vice president. The exceptions, again, being court justices, Dupac chair, and the speaker of the Senate, which are all blatantly outlined in the Constitution and bylaws.
Okay.
My question to you, Mr. Staley, is before you went in for that meeting in which the decision was made, in collaboration with the vice president and the two advisors to fire Mr. Barney, did you take the consideration that there was no provision in the Constitution for anybody to fire, you know, the executive assistant when you guys went in and had that meeting? Did you know ahead of time that, I mean, the Constitution doesn't give me the power to fire, but I'll go ahead and do this because I think it's in the either in the best interest of the student body or for whatever reason we did it. Take that into consideration.
When we went in for the meeting, we did consider the fact that nowhere in either document was anyone afforded such authority. And it was only after Speaker Sidula's refusal to take any action that the possibility of another alternative was actually discussed between Vice President Blanqui and I. And at that point, the decision basically came down to a similar model to the way the university is structured, with the chancellor having final budgetary authority over the people working within his office and his organization. That's the model that we applied to student government.
Thank you very much.
I came up with some questions. Looking at Exhibit G, I understand that you had discussions with Mr. Sibula and that he refused to take any action towards termination, so he didn't want to serve, or didn't want to terminate Barney, Mr. Barney. Or
something that was left out of the statement was that in the meeting, Speaker Sibula's position did seem varied as to whether or not he was in favor of termination or being not in favor of termination. That did vary over time, but specifically, he took no action towards termination. I don't necessarily see it as a specific refusal. It was never like he came out and said to me, no, there's no way this is happening. It was just a lack of action in my mind, really.
And then one more question. You say that the budget for SGA, do you make the budget for Senate? Because I understand there's only two paid positions. Who makes the budget for those two? Who comes up with the budget for that?
The Senate, as well as the court and SUFAC, all submit their budgetary considerations to myself and Vice President Blanqui, at which point we compile the final budget. So we oversee what goes into or comes out of the budget at the point that it is delivered to SUFAC.
I don't know if you would allow both parties to at least give a short closing statement before we wrap up.
In a minute. I have a couple questions here. Can you explain Mr. Mock and Mr. Barney, can you explain why you think that if an individual is able to hire and supervise another individual, can you explain why it is only, or it is, they have the sole power to terminate that position and no one else has the power?
Well, what I tried to accomplish through my oral argument was to establish that there's a separation of power between the executive and the Senate. And essentially what Mr. Barney believes is that the executive had overreached into a responsibility that has been traditionally held by the Senate Speaker, who hires the assistant for the Senate. So...
Well, you want to say that traditionally the Senate Speaker has dealt with that responsibility, because there's no precedent of the Senate Speaker firing an executive assistant.
That's
so
correct. That's what I was saying.
I don't think that makes sense, but in terms of hiring, yes. You know.
I'm sure that when they were writing the bylaws that we thought, it's never going to come down to this. The Senate executive has, never really played a major role or has, created any controversy. But, things happen. We overlook things, and that's why we have a court to decide these things and to deduce from the information that we're given and to make a decision, and to make a decisive decision at that. You are more than welcome to give this back to the Senate if they like, but I think it's going to be highly probable that the minutes are changed, that the Speaker is given that authority anyway. And in that case, I think that would change this case. If they do in fact put that in there, then there is no, then the executive has no right to then start firing the Senate executive assistant. I think that would change the case completely if that's what you decided to do. So this wouldn't even be here if it was for that.
Mr. Mack.
Yes.
Aren't you of the opinion that if that were to happen, what you just prescribed, we'll be back in the pyramid model where we're going to have the Speaker at the top of the pyramid and everybody else at the bottom? What would be different from that model?
I believe it would be different. I would more or less see it as three tiers, and that the way, and this is the way it is in the federal government and the state governments. We have the executive, and he's right here, and then he is in charge of all of his secretaries and his chairs, and he performs the tasks that he thinks is best for the Senate. Then you have the Chief Justice in charge of the court. He's in charge of procedural matters, getting things done with the court. That is more of a shared power, but he's technically at the top. And then you have technically the Vice President of the Vice President of SGA, but technically it's the Speaker who runs all of the Senate. The Speaker decides what's on the agenda. He gets all the work done. The Vice President, in essence, is ex officio and just presides over it. I would say it's tiers, and they're separate, but they're equal at the same time. I think the way that it was explained was the pyramid is what he's tried to, in my opinion, that's what comes out of his brief, but I think in reality it's more of these tiers, and they're separate.
Okay, back to that question. Generally, not necessarily in student government, does the fact that a manager, if they have the authority to hire and supervise an employee, does that imply that no one else can fire that employee?
I would say that I think in a business situation that's a little different, because the head of a business is essentially the head of a business. There is no
right, but
power in a business.
Speaking of, does it imply, does hiring and supervising necessarily imply that only that person that hires and supervises is able to terminate the employee?
I think it's in a business, yes.
Cool. I would say in a business, no, and that's the point we're making, is that our government is not a business. Like, in the business...
So it doesn't necessarily imply that... that individual is the only one able to terminate an employee.
I think we have to separate all other situations from government, because government is structured in a different way. other situation will have almost this pyramid effect, and that in essence we can't refer to those situations. We have to look at it from a governmental standpoint.
And if you look at it from a governmental standpoint, you're of your opinion that the degrees of duties across the three arms of government are equal on every level. That the president gets to do the same amount of work as I do, and the same amount of work as the executive assistants do, or Senate president. You know, everybody's position is equal just because we're an SGA with equal arms of government. Or does the presidential, the president and the vice president and the rest of the executive branch, by virtue of their responsibilities and what they do, carry some kind of an extra burden on behalf of the student body? Do you think so, or don't you?
They carry more responsibility within the executive branch. They have a lot more responsibility in that regard. My comment of them being equal is that one doesn't hold more authority than the other one. The president, he has to execute the office of the presidency. It probably takes a lot more to do that because of the scope and what he has to do than some other branches, but he doesn't hold any more authority over anybody else than the Chief Justice does. That's the way our government's set up. We do that purposely.
Okay. So your opinion there, extra responsibility does not carry extra authority.
Does anyone have a final question?
To a certain extent. I mean...
Final question?
No.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. The court agrees that each party will have 3 minutes for closing arguments, starting with Mr. Mock and Mr. Varney.
We get caught up in a lot of rules in SGA, and what for? That particular opinion, we couldn't really do too much with it. It was the nature of the beast. But reflecting upon it, I took that comment very seriously because I work in the legal profession right now. I'm going to law school next semester. My role on the court, the rules were my life, and they continue to be my life. Everything that I do in a work setting and here revolves around rules. And after reflecting on that particular statement that she had made, this case, in essence, had answered that for me. There was a real controversy. The president decided to fire someone who the lines of authority, in my own opinion, are very clear, but in his opinion, they're not. But he lost his job. And this was an employment issue. This is his employment. He relied on it for income. This was a very serious decision that... In many regards, wasn't taken very seriously. I ask that this court find in favor of the petitioner that not only that the Senate Speaker, deduced from the language of Article 6, has the authority to fire, but that Mr. Staley has not connected the pieces from being the financial officer and the executive to having somehow this authority to fire the Senate Executive Assistant. I stress separation of powers. That's why we're here. The Wisconsin statutes say we can organize ourselves in the manner that we see fit, and we've done that. We've done that in a governmental structure, and we have to abide by these rules. That's why we have them. It was a serious decision that was made, and at this point, all that Mr. Varney has left is a little piece of justice. That, you know what, not everything was followed probably the way it should have. People should have been included in this decision that were not. And that's all we ask at this point. We're not asking for punitive damages, compensatory damages. We can't even get reinstatement at this point. We're asking for a very small bit of justice. Thank you.
Mr. Staley?
As Mr. Mock said several times, we do have the ability to organize ourselves as we see fit, and we have organized ourselves the way we have into government association. As such, as much as our government mirrors the federal government, we do not follow the U.S. Constitution as our primary document. We follow the Student Government Association Constitution. Vice President Blonte and I acted in accordance with our interpretation of the Constitution. and that's it. We acted according to how we see our roles as it's described in the Student Government Association Constitution. At the risk of sounding redundant, regardless of either the petitioner or our interpretation of either of these documents, in neither document is termination explicitly afforded to anyone.
Okay. Any questions?
No.
Questions? No? Okay. Seeing none, meeting is adjourned, or hearing is adjourned at 6:08.
Thank you.
Good job being on your toes there.
Thank you.
Brian.